Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and this is an episode of The Weekly Docket where I recap some of the top headlines in true crime for this week. If you're listening to this podcast, great, I'm glad you're here. But also, just so you know, there is going to be a video component to this episode. So if you'd rather watch on YouTube or wherever you get your video content, whether that's through Patreon, it'll be on there too. So if you're interested in joining our Patreon, that's patreon.com/mamamystery. And you can get exclusive ad-free content there, including a few bonus episodes as well. So without further ado, there's a lot to cover this week in true crime. So let's jump in. Now, our first story is coming out of Houston, Texas. And Houston has always had a complicated relationship with its bayous, apparently. They cut through the city like these winding veins, shaping the landscape and serving as a natural drainage. But some of those waterways often turn up some grim discoveries. This September, that reality came into sharp focus when five bodies were pulled from different bayous in just 6 days, sparking public speculation, social media theories, and official pushback from city leaders. The story begins with 20-year-old Jade McKissick, a junior at the University of Houston. On the night of September 11th, Jade went out with some friends, later splitting off on her own, which, red flag, you should never leave your friends. Never let your friends go off on their own. She left her phone behind at a bar, grabbed a drink at a nearby gas station, and was last seen walking toward Bray's Bayou near Scott Street and McGregor around 1 o'clock in the morning. For days, nobody heard from her. Her family actually reported her missing on September 14th. And then the very next day, September 15th, firefighters and Houston police recovered her body from Bray's Bayou near Spur 5, about 2.5 miles from where she was last seen. The initial autopsy found no obvious signs of trauma or foul play. Her cause of death is still pending, waiting on toxicology reports to fill in some of the blanks. But that same day, while officials were still processing the news about Jade, another recovery took place. A second body was pulled from a canal off of East Freeway in the Greens Bayou area. Now, in this case, the medical examiner quickly ruled natural causes and investigators closed it without further criminal inquiry. And still, two bodies in a single day was enough to get people's attention. Then came September 16th. A third body surfaced in the White Oak Bayou near Taylor Street, just north of downtown. Investigators on the scene said drowning was likely the cause, but like the others, a full autopsy will be needed to confirm. By September 18th, another case had developed. A witness reported seeing a man near Buffalo Bayou and never resurfaced. Authorities searched the area and recovered remains later that day. The medical examiner has not released an identity or a cause of death in that case. But the week closed out on September 20th with a kayaker spotting a body floating in Buffalo Bayou near Hirsch Road and Clinton Drive in the East End. So Houston Police Department recovered the remains, marking the fifth body pulled from a Houston waterway in less than 1 week. And in the age of TikTok and quickfire theories, it didn't take long before rumors of a serial killer along the bayous began to spread online. Some users dubbed the supposed predator as the Rainy Street Ripper, drawing connections between the clustered discoveries, if you will. But city officials were quick to shut down those theories, and Mayor John Whitmire and Police Chief J. No Diaz both said that there is no evidence connecting the cases. They pointed out that Houston's waterways are inherently dangerous and often the sites of drownings, accidents, or natural cause deaths. The numbers do seem to back that up. As of late September, Houston has seen 14 bodies recovered from bayous in 2025, compared to 24 last year. While the pace of discoveries in mid-September was unusual, it isn't outside the historical range of what investigators deal with in a given year. So where do things stand now? Well, at this point, only Jade McKissick has been publicly identified. The other four victims remain unnamed while medical examiners work on identification and determining the causes of their deaths. And for now, each case is being handled separately unless forensic evidence shows some kind of overlap. But that obviously leaves the city in kind of a holding pattern. While families wait for answers, autopsy results are pending, and police continue to stress patients, urging people to avoid drawing connections before the evidence is clear. And the Bayous, as always, keep their secrets. That is until the next discovery brings Houston's attention back to the water. Our next story is coming out of Wasilla, Anchorage, Alaska. In 2023, 18-year-old Ataja Banks vanished from Anchorage, Alaska. She was last heard from in mid-September of that year, and when her family could no longer reach her, they reported her missing in October. Ataja's disappearance left more questions than answers. There were no major leads, no confirmed sightings, and little progress made for months. Her case slowly shifted from a missing persons alert into what looked like a cold case, though her family never stopped pressing for answers. Well, that changed 2 years later when on September 4th of 2025, human remains were discovered near Moose Meadows Road in Wasilla, a wooded area outside of Anchorage. The Alaska State Troopers, already familiar with Ataja's case, quickly involved the state medical examiner's office, and after forensic testing, authorities confirmed what her family had feared for years, that the remains did in fact belong to Ataja Banks. With that confirmation, the case officially moved from a missing person file to a homicide investigation. Investigators haven't shared many details about what led them to classify her death as homicide, but the shift means they found enough in the condition of the remains or the surrounding scene to believe that her death was not accidental. Autopsy work is still ongoing to determine the exact cause. The focus now is on building out a timeline of Ataja's final days. Detectives are working backwards from September of 2023, reviewing her last known communications, movements, and relationships. They're also combing through missing persons reports and tips that came in over the years, hoping to connect them with what they've now uncovered. Authorities say they are especially interested in witnesses who might have seen her near Wasilla around the time that she disappeared, or anyone who noticed suspicious activity in the area where her remains were eventually found. And for the Banks family, the discovery brings a measure of clarity, but not closure, because after 2 years of uncertainty, they now know what happened to Ataja, but not why, and not who is responsible. Police have not named any suspects publicly, and they haven't confirmed whether they have any persons of interest. And that silence kind of suggests that the investigation is still in its early, delicate stages where leads are being chased, but just not made public. In Alaska, missing persons cases often face extra hurdles. Because of their vast wilderness, harsh weather, and isolated terrain, it can make searches incredibly difficult, and it's not uncommon for bodies to go undiscovered for months or even years. Ataja's case fits into that reality, and she disappeared in Anchorage, but her remains were found miles away in Wasilla, raising new questions about how she got there and whether she was taken against her will. So as of now, the homicide investigation remains active, and authorities are asking the public for tips. Anyone with any information, even small details from 2023 that might have seemed insignificant at the time, could help fill in some of the gaps. Our next story brings us to Long Island, New York, where the Gilgo Beach murders have haunted Long Island for more than a decade. In 2010 and 2011, police searching the area for a missing woman stumbled onto something far larger, a cluster of human remains scattered along Ocean Parkway near Gilgo Beach. Over time, the number of victims linked to that area grew, with at least 10 sets of remains tied to that case. The sheer scale and brutality earned the case national attention and the nickname the Long Island Serial Killer. For years, progress was really slow. Leads ran dry, suspects came and went, and the case lingered without any resolution. But that changed in July of 2023 when investigators arrested Rex Huerman, a 59-year-old architect from Massapequa Park. He was charged with murdering three women, Megan Waterman, Melissa Barthelemy, and Amber Costello, all of whom disappeared in 2009 and 2010. A fourth victim, Maureen Brainard Barnes, was later added to the indictment, and by 2025, the state was preparing to tie Huerman to even more victims. The defense team pushed back. They argued that the cases should be split into separate trials, one for each victim or group of victims. And their reasoning was simple, that the evidence is different for each woman, and combining them could confuse a jury or unfairly bias them by stacking the allegations together. If a juror wants to hear evidence from one victim's case, the defense worried that they might assume guilt across all the charges. So this past week, a New York judge rejected that request. Huerman will now face a single consolidated trial covering 7 murder counts. Prosecutors argued, and the judge agreed, that the cases are too closely connected to separate. The women disappeared under similar circumstances, worked in similar professions, and their remains were all discovered in the same area of Gilgo Beach. Investigators also believe they have overlapping evidence with burner phone records, DNA testing, and even surveillance that ties Rex Huerman to multiple victims. So the ruling is a major win for the prosecution. A consolidated trial allows them to present their case as a cohesive story, like a pattern of behavior stretching over years, instead of fragmenting it into separate courtrooms. It also means witnesses and families won't have to relive the trauma multiple times in different trials. So for the defense, this ruling makes the fight ahead much harder. They now have to prepare for a courtroom where jurors will hear about all 7 victims at once. Their strategy will likely focus on discrediting forensic evidence, such as new DNA techniques that prosecutors want to introduce, which is always kind of a risky move, because anytime you're introducing any kind of new technique, it allows for the defense to poke holes in that and basically question its credibility. But they're also going to be poking holes in the narrative that all the cases are connected. They had also tried to exclude some of the state's DNA testing by arguing that the lab handling was not properly permitted, but that motion was denied as well. As it stands, the pretrial schedule is moving forward. The judge has set January 13th as the deadline for all pretrial motions, and after that, the trial date will be set. No firm trial date has been announced yet, but given the scope of the case with 7 victims, hundreds, if not thousands, of pieces of evidence, and of course, years of investigation, jury selection and testimony will likely stretch for months once it begins. For the families of the victims, this latest decision feels like a step toward answers in a case that's been stalled for more than a decade. And for Rex Huerman, it means one unified trial where the state will attempt to prove that he was the predator haunting Long Island's beaches for years. Now, I've never done a deep dive on this case. I have watched some documentaries. I believe there's one on Hulu or Peacock. One of them, it's about living with a serial killer. Like, that's not the name of it, but that's like the premise, because the documentary mostly focuses on interviewing Rex's wife and children who don't believe that Rex could possibly be responsible for all of these murders. It's very eerily similar to the BTK situation, where he just truly led on this double life. But if you guys are interested in a deep dive on that, please let me know in either the comments of this episode, or you can let me know on mamamystery.com. You can scroll down to a white box where you can leave me a message. If you want me to know who you are, though, make sure you write on the message who you are and where you're from, because otherwise it will be anonymous.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5.
I know where I'm going to bet from now on.
Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Now, our next story is out of Waldorf, Maryland, where just a week ago, 34-year-old Rondale Dickerson and his fiance, Shalaya Broadwater, who's 40 years old, were celebrating their engagement. And now Dickerson is in custody, accused of murdering the very woman that he had just proposed to. The case unfolded in a suburban community about 30 miles south of Washington, D.C. on September 16th of 2025, when Charles County Sheriff's deputies were called to a home on Hanover Drive for a reported stabbing. When they arrived, they found Broadwater suffering from multiple stab wounds. Paramedics rushed her to the University of Maryland Charles Regional Medical Center, but she later died from her injuries. Investigators quickly focused on Dickerson, who was at the scene, and according to charging documents, the couple had been arguing inside the home when the fight escalated into violence. Police allege that Dickerson pulled a knife out and stabbed Broadwater several times in her torso. Deputies say Broadwater's teenage son was present during the attack and ran to get help. Neighbors later told reporters that they were shocked. They had seen the couple celebrating recently, with posts on social media showing Shalaya happily showing off her engagement ring. And by all outward appearances, things were looking up. So the sudden turn to violence has just left family, friends, and neighbors totally stunned. After the stabbing, Dickerson was arrested without incident and transported to the Charles County Detention Center. Prosecutors charged him with first-degree murder, first-degree assault, and reckless endangerment. At his initial court appearance, a judge ordered him held without bond while the case moves forward. Police have not publicly shared a motive beyond describing the incident as the result of a domestic argument. Investigators are now reviewing prior calls to the residence, digital communications, and witness statements to build a timeline of the relationship and any red flags that may have been missed. For now, the focus is on preparing the case for trial. Prosecutors will likely lean on witness testimony, including that of Shalaya's son, physical evidence from the crime scene, and any history of domestic disputes. Defense attorneys have not commented publicly on how they intend to approach the charges, but what stands out in this case is obviously just how quickly it spiraled. One week, Shalaya is announcing her engagement, and then days later, her own fiancé takes her life, allegedly. But the investigation is ongoing. Authorities are treating this as a clear case of intimate partner violence turned deadly. Now, this last story is gaining a lot of traction on social media. I've seen a lot of people talking about it, and it brings us to Dallas, Texas. On the morning of September 10th, an ordinary workday at a small Dallas motel turned into one of the most brutal crime scenes that the city has seen in years. Chandra Mooley, or Bob Nagamalaya, I think that's how you say it. The 50-year-old manager of the Downtown Suites in Dallas was attacked and killed by one of his own employees. And the assault unfolded in front of his wife and son, and the details are almost too shocking to believe. So Bob had lived at the motel with his family, running day-to-day operations while also keeping the property in order. That morning, he confronted a coworker, 37-year-old Jordanis Cobos Martinez, about using a washing machine that had been out of order. So because Martinez spoke limited English, another female employee tried to translate. And instead of diffusing the situation, the translation seemed to more so inflame it. Witnesses later said that Martinez grew angry, feeling insulted that Bob would not address him directly, and he stormed out of the laundry room in frustration. Then a few minutes later, Martinez returned, this time carrying a machete. Around 8:20 a.m., he confronted Bob in the hallway near the front office and began swinging. Bob tried to run toward the lobby, bleeding as he stumbled, while his wife, Nisha, and son, Gaurav, rushed forward to try and help him. They pulled and screamed, doing everything they could to stop the attack, but Martinez shoved them aside and kept going. In moments, the assault escalated past the point of rescue, and Bob was struck in the neck several times until he was decapitated. What happened next left witnesses in horror. Martinez kicked Bob's severed head across the parking lot, picked it up, and tossed it into a dumpster. By the time paramedics arrived around 8:30, he was still there, drenched in blood, holding the machete, and police arrested him on the spot without further struggle. Martinez was booked into the Dallas County Jail and charged with capital murder, which is the most serious charge under Texas law. Of course, we already know Texas does have the death penalty, especially in capital murder cases. According to investigators, he admitted to the killing during questioning, citing the argument over the broken washing machine as the reason that he snapped. Detectives are now digging into this background to see if there were prior warning signs of violent behavior. Bob's killing devastated his family, traumatized his family, I'm sure, especially the ones who had to witness it, and of course shocked the Dallas community. Friends and neighbors described him as kind, hardworking, and a man who cared deeply for his family and treated motel guests with nothing but respect. His funeral was held just 3 days later, with relatives and members of the North Texas Indian community gathering to grieve and raise funds to support his wife and son. Plans were made to send his remains back to India for final rites. So now the case is moving through the courts. Prosecutors will determine whether to pursue the death penalty, while investigators continue to interview motel employees and residents about any previous disputes between Bob and Martinez. For Bob's family, the tragedy is almost, it is, it's not almost, it is impossible to comprehend that they could watch something so vile and vicious and disturbing happen. And then the way that he completely desecrated his remains by kicking his head around the parking lot like a fucking soccer ball is, it's too gruesome. It's too gruesome to even comprehend. That's all I can say about it. Now, that is it for this week's Weekly Docket. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you hit subscribe. Make sure you're following us on all of our channels so you never miss a future episode. If you're watching on YouTube, welcome. My hope is to make this a regular thing, and I've said this before, so you can totally come for me for that, and I will completely understand because I've been so wishy-washy about doing video content, but after this last time at CrimeCon, I met so many video creators that I thought to myself, there's no reason that I shouldn't be implementing this. So my hope is that now that I figured out the webcam, the mic, I figured it all out, I think that hopefully it'll get easier and easier and you guys will get to know me more on a personal level, being able to see me in person. So anyway, if you liked this episode, let me know, share it with your friends to keep them in the loop of what's going on in the world. And with that said, I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. Stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out. Bye.